It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Schizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
Tell us about the first time you got to see Touch of Evil.
It opened in 1958 in New York. I was living in Manhattan. It opened in either the top or the bottom half of a double bill, which is the way pictures that the studios didn't think much of opened those days. It opened in a lot of theaters at once, which in those days was an insult. Now it's the way every film is done, but in those days, if you opened a film on a double bill meaning two films, an A picture and a B picture, playing at what they used to call the neighborhood theaters or the names, that was considered that the picture was being thrown away, and that's how it opened in New York. I went to the first screening. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I went with a good friend of mine. We enjoyed it. We loved it. Just slipped out, and there was hardly anybody in the theater, and the reviews were poor. The same day, my father brought, same day, just a couple of days later or before, my father was a painter and an artist and kind of an intellectual type, and he used to bring back art magazines. He'd go and buy art magazines. He brought back a French newspaper called ARTS. And on the front page was a long piece by François Truffaut with a picture from Touch of Evil and calling it Welles' masterpiece. So I thought, well, there's a little difference between Paris and New York, I guess.
Were you a Welles fan already at the time?
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have gone to see it so early in the morning.
Okay, fair enough. I say, how much impact did he have on you as a filmmaker? How much influence did he have on you as a filmmaker? I mean, obviously, besides enough coming to Indianapolis to talk about it.
Well, I mean, he had more influence on me as a personality than directly as a filmmaker because we're very different in terms of the way we make pictures. But he opened my vision a lot. And made me realize that nothing had to be set in stone. You could prepare a picture, but still leave yourself open to the possibility that something better might come along on the day you're shooting or just before the camera turns. He kept to a kind of freshness with the actors. He also was very, very... gregarious and open and funny on the set. Now, I was the same way, so we had that in common. But seeing Orson do it kind of validated it for me.
I think also, his films were events, and also the fact that the filmmaker got to be a brand or a star product. And I remember as a kid, I mean, you were in the same boat with directors like Coppola and Scorsese. It was a Peter Bogdanovich film, no matter who was in it. The main thing was that it was your film as a director.
Well, that became the issue in the early 70s, late 60s, or mainly in the early 70s. I was the first filmmaker of my generation that got the billing of film buy, which is a French or European billing. I didn't ask for it. They just gave it to me.
Hmm.
And I would have preferred a Peter Bogdanovich production, which I took on What's Up Doc and Paper Moon. But they gave me that, and it was in all the ads, and it was pretty big type. And it started the whole American tour thing over here.
Mm-hmm. Besides,
how did I feel about it?
I felt
a little intimidated by it, and didn't think about being in the forefront of anything. It just was the way it worked out.
Besides making cinema history, I know one of the things I've really appreciated is that you've been a teacher of cinema history with your books and the commentaries and the appearances and all the documentaries and whatnot. Was education always a part of your goal as an artist?
Never. It's just that I never thought of it as education. I thought of it as popularization. I thought I was keeping the flame alive of films that I liked, which pop culture, has a short shelf life, and unfortunately, I've come to realize how short the shelf life is. It's gotten shorter and shorter.
Now, if I'm going through my personal collection and stuff that I've done research on, have you done commentaries on all of your films that are on DVD?
I don't think I did one on Texas Will because it's not the version that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I did one on Noise Is Off because they didn't ask me. I don't think there is any commentary on that one.
Okay.
Which I wish there were because it's one of my favorites.
Well, you're always informative when you give the commentaries. Film host and film buff, I go back to the word education. It is for me as far as learning what you did and how you did it. And what I've liked over the years with DVD was it was finally satisfying to hear the music of Bruce Springsteen in Mask, and last year to finally see Nickelodeon in black and white.
Yeah, if you enjoyed it, you can imagine how much I was so happy to get them right finally after 30 years or something.
I'm trying to remember. Do you know if At Long Last Love will ever make it onto DVD?
I don't know. It was such a disaster. The version that the good cut, which has been shown on television and exclusively, nobody ever saw the original release cut ever again. I guess it might. They have a very good print at Fox, very beautiful print. They just and people rent it occasionally. It was shown in a tribute to me in San Francisco against my better judgment, but they liked it, so they showed it.
Well, I figured if a film like Mamma Mia could get made today, then that film would be worth looking at again.
That's what they said up in San Francisco, and the critic who'd seen it before re-reviewed it, re-evaluated it, thought it was pretty damn good. I don't know what I think of it. It was a good idea. It was compromised a bit, but I could do it better if I had to do it over again.
Okay. The museum that is hosting Touch of Evil, next month they're showing Last Picture Show. I wasn't sure if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, they are, February 19th. And we had an art house theater in town a few years ago that closed, and their last movie they showed was The Last Picture Show.
That's appropriate.
Very appropriate, indeed. My gosh, that film is almost 40 years old, and it doesn't feel dated at all.
Thank you.
Yes. When was the last time you watched it?
Maybe a year and a half ago, I saw it with an audience. Played the certain pictures you make play the same way no matter what year or what audience. That's a sure sign that it's going to last. I'm very proud to say that it played that the way it played when it opened.
And that was one of those films where, it launched a lot of careers, obviously, with Jeff Bridges and Cybill Shepherd and Randy Quaid, and was able to put Ben Johnson and Cloris Leachman to a new level. Ellen Burstyn was in that, of course. You just look at on paper and you think, wow, 10 years after that, the budget would have been and their salaries would have been much, much more.
Oh, yeah. We made the picture film not for nothing. It was $1.3 million.
And that was a book that paperback that you picked up at a store?
That's how it started, but then I didn't buy it. Sal Mineo brought it, the same paperback, a few days later, and gave it to me. I thought there must be something to this, so I guess I better read it. Sal always liked the book and thought he'd be good in it, but he was too old for it by the time he gave it to me. He thought I'd like it, which he was right, I did.
Jumping forward, a film that I really enjoyed, and I was curious about how you got involved with it, was the Tom Petty documentary, Running Down a Dream.
I loved doing that. That was such fun. Well, Tom was wanting to make a 30th anniversary film, documentary, and he and a good friend of his, a producer named George Reculius, who was a friend of mine, were talking, and Tom said, who can we get to do the documentary? And George said, how about Bogdanovich? And Tom said, do you think we could get him? He said, I don't know, let me call him. So he called me and asked me if I'd be interested. And I didn't know much about Tom Petty, but I'm interested in things I don't know much about. Didn't know much about Texas either. So I knew he was a big name in rock and roll. And I said, sure, I'd be interested. Why are you asking me? He said, because Tom likes your stuff and he thinks you'd be good to do it. I said, well, let's meet. So I flew out to California and met with Tom. We talked for 4 hours and I said, okay, I know how to do it. I think I know how to do it. At least I know how to approach it, and I'd like to do it. And that was it.
I was impressed with how thorough it was, and despite its length, I wanted more.
Yeah. When you get the right rhythm for a picture, you can go on and on. It took us a long time to find the right rhythm for it, and but once we got it, it just flows. I've seen it with audiences, you know, on the big screen, and it's very exciting.
And I think of when Scorsese did The Last Waltz and Shine a Light, and Jonathan Demme's done Stop Making Sense and Heart of Gold. Does it change you as a filmmaker to go from concert music documentary to working on a feature? Does it change your mindset at all?
No, because it's a different kind of thing. I mean, the Tom Petty would have been impossible to make. It had to be digital. You couldn't cut that picture in the way I made, you know, let's say The Last Picture Show or What's Up Doc or Paper Moon or even Mask or even The Catch Now. It can't be cut nor normally. You have to have digital editing in order to be able to do all that kind of fancy footwork, which the rock documentary requires. And, I mean, it would have took long enough with the way we were doing it. I can't imagine how you could do it before a digital cutting.
And how do you feel about digital?
Oh, I think it's fine. It speeds up the process. That's all.
Okay. What are you currently working on, either as a director or as an actor?
A little acting here and there and some pictures, but I'm working on a few pictures as a director. I'm trying to put together a couple of pictures, and people are trying to get me to do a couple of things. I'm not sure what I'm going to do first, but I'll be doing something this year, probably in May or June. Not sure what, so I can't really tell you because I'm not 100% sure, but a very different kind of project.
Okay. And I guess because this is a film talk show, I'm curious what you've seen recently, whether it's old or new or either.
Well, I liked Fabulous Mr. Fox a lot. That was one of my favorite films this year.
Mine too.
I loved it. I thought Up in the Air was good. I liked Clooney in it a lot. I liked The Two Women.
Mm-hmm.
And what else is there? I haven't seen Avatar, and I haven't seen a lot of pictures. I enjoyed Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock Holmes. And I haven't seen a lot of pictures.
Crazy Heart, by chance?
I thought Jeff was extraordinary, and the picture's charming.
I agree. He's
Jeff is just amazing. Great, great, great performance.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great actor. He's always been a great actor. I knew that the minute we worked with him way back when.
It's funny when people still call him underrated, even though he has 4 nominations and a 5th one probably on the way.
Well, he still is underrated because he's right up there among the best actors of his generation. I think everybody knows it, but the public.
I think Crazy Heart's one of his best works.
Oh, yeah, he's brilliant.
But I really, really appreciate your time, Peter. And I guess I have to say, on behalf of all the male listeners to the show, thank you for the diving board scene in Last Picture Show.
Okay.
It helped out a lot of us, so.
I'm glad. Glad to be of service.
Peter Bogdanovich, thank you so much for being on Film Sociology.
Thanks, Matthew.
Joining me on Film Sociology is a woman, an actress, who most recently has now played the most angelic Irish mother in cinema history. Connie Nielsen, how are you?
I am very well. How are you?
I think you stole Brenda Fricker's title from My Left Foot.
All right.
Tell us, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about A Shine of Rainbows.
A Shine of Rainbows is the story of a couple who live on a remote island in the north, between Ireland and Scotland, during the 60s, early 60s. These are very sort of backwards kinds of places, but incredibly beautiful. And this couple have not been able to have any children. And the film starts basically with the woman going to an orphanage on the mainland and choosing a child to bring home. And her way of dealing with life is by embracing it, by loving life. And she expresses that through a love of nature, of colors. And she just exudes this warmth when she chooses this child who is a very backwards child. He can hardly actually even speak. He stutters, and he is afraid of his own shadow. And he literally comes to this place and is the most wretched little boy. And my husband, played by Aidan Quinn, is having a hard time understanding why I've taken such a weak, so to speak,
The runt of the litter, I believe he says.
That's right. He calls it the runt of the litter. And he's having a hard time recognizing his own, you know, personality in this boy, and doesn't know how to communicate with him. And instead, Maire, my character, she goes about giving him little chores that he can succeed at. She gives him his own room. She has made this, you know, knitted these beautiful sweaters for him. She just keeps on showing him life and love and warmth, and he starts to bloom in her presence. And yet, for some reason, her husband is simply not warming up to this child, and this becomes a problem a bit later when my character becomes very ill.
Yes, I think you cough in the first 10 minutes. That's required, I believe.
Yes.
And now, did they have to CG out your halo and your golden glow in this film? Because one of the things I really enjoyed about it's a very sweet film, obviously,
yes.
And hopefully folks will go see it, is that you think you've seen every aspect of typical or stereotypical Irish cinema, and there are elements of this film that you don't get. That you don't get the flowing green, and you have a married couple that show, you know, that are tender with each other, and
yes.
even Quinn, you know, the tough Irish dad.
Yeah.
There's more layers to him as well. So it was nice to see a new twist on an old story, or at least old stock characters.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that I they always like show one kind of Ireland, and I really feel that. It was a wonderful combination of this really rugged place where we were shooting, and at the same time, we were blessed with such unusual, glorious weather while we were shooting that even the locals thought that we were blessed with some kind of extra luck. And that kind of glow is, I think, what you kind of see in the film as well. We were all really grateful for this wonderful, you know, weather, and I think it really suited the film as well.
It's you, Connie, because it really is. he spoke, and it had good weather, you know, and you got to sort of make out with Aidan Quinn.
And how did you like my Irish accent? Did you buy it?
Well, you know what? Well, of course, I went to the source of all information, the internet, and saw that you spoke several different languages fluently, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well, then, yeah, I think you could wrap your mouth around that, sassy lass.
I so enjoyed speaking Irish. It was just such a lovely sound to make, and like great rhythm in the language. It's beautiful.
Speak Irish for me.
Yeah.
No, it's a new variation of
talking. Yeah,
talk.
It's not
going to
happen. I would never do that.
Fine. No. Well, no. Then I'd have to pay you, and that's a whole other thing.
Yes, exactly.
Now, where exactly did you guys shoot the film, and how long did it take?
This is up at the very, like one of the very northernmost points of Ireland. And we shot it. I was there personally for 5 weeks, and they had started a couple of weeks before me. So it was a short but comfortable shoot, very comfortable. And I had just had a baby within that first year. It was like 9 months when I went to shoot. So it was it was a very sort of family-oriented atmosphere. We had all our kids on the set, and we basically rehearsed with my baby on my hip, and then he just sat in my little chair and looked at us while we did the scene and didn't say a word. It was a very sort of welcoming, warm atmosphere while we were shooting.
How much did he get? Hey, you got work. My wife's equity, and you know that means I think the daughter's equity. So
well, he wasn't quite on screen, so.
Screen?
If not, you know, we wouldn't have had a story. You know?
Come on, Connie, screen credits. We know this. You have a personal assistant slash assist. Yeah, inspiration.
Exactly.
I say, as an actor, as an actress, what did you get out of working with Aidan Quinn?
Well, you know, this is my second time of working with Aidan. We're getting to feel really comfortable with each other.
First time was.
The first one was that title changed in English. It was called Return to Sender in Europe. I forget what it was released as here in America.
I'll check.
But anyways, so we already knew each other really well, and it was just which was really great for the film, because we just had this real comfort and knowledge of each other when we were playing this married couple.
And I know this was John Bell's first film. How do you work with somebody, one, who's playing your son, and one, it's also, I think, it was his first film?
He's so amazing. He's one of those kids that he knew that he was an actor a long time ago and just had an instinctual understanding of the craft of acting. And I've always treated all actors the same, you know, whether they're child actors or adult actors, and that is, you know, just having a great respect for the other person's craft. And with John, it was that much more easy, just because he is so much an actor. You sometimes forget that he's a kid. He's really good, and he's very knowledgeable about what he does already. I'm so astounded by this kid.
I mean, was there bonding sessions that you do when you're not shooting?
Well, I sort of always try to become like the mother who is not there for them, and it just happens to be a natural thing for me. I have four kids back home here, so it's just a normal thing for me.
I say, how did you get about to this project? I mean, this is very personal. It's
personal.
If it was a good world, it would open on 3,000 screens.
I know. It's one of those little stories where your agent calls and says, you know, the script, it's very moving. You know, I don't know if you want to do anything. Just, you know, read it and see what you think. And then I get the thing, and I'm obviously not even thinking of going back to work. I'm still breastfeeding, and I just can't even imagine going back to work. And I start reading it, and by page 30, I'm literally weeping. And I didn't even finish the script. I just called my agent and said I'd do it.
If you don't mind me asking, how old are your kids?
20, 11, 8, and 3.
That's impossible.
True.
No.
Oh, yes, yes.
And what do they think? How much of mom's work have they seen?
Well, you know, most of my work is R-rated, so yes. They haven't seen an awful lot.
I wonder.
Another reason for me trying to get a little bit more, you know, kid-friendly in my choices here. I've gone from doing rather artsy pictures to much more family-friendly style pictures. And it's good for my relationship with my kids. Now they actually do believe me when I say that I'm off working.
Yeah, but do they get up to – but do kids up to there just go, hey, I saw your mom in The Devil's Advocate?
No, I know. And literally, like, my oldest son, he's been through that. And he's
Mother!
Sort of like, and I said, well, how do you deal with it? He just like says, you know, well, you know, we're European. It's like the thing is, well, we're European. So
nice comeback.
I think so.
You know, looking back, it's been, as I was going through your IMDb, one thing that it popped to mind was how many not only the variety, but what really cool directors you've worked with over the years, from Ridley Scott to Taylor Hackford to De Palma and Wes Anderson. I mean, it's that's got to be a nice feather in the cap.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's always been, you know, about trying to make the best movie I could. You know, that's what it's always been about. And then, of course, it's also been about trying to explode, whatever limits were being put on it just because I'm a girl. You know, it's a constant trying to explode, you know, whatever little boxes people would like to put you in, you know.
Woman, Connie, woman.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when I started, I was a girl.
That,
so.
Well, I give you that. That's true.
Thank you. You should see me. I'm still pretty girly.
I saw the film, and I'll go and Google you later. And I mean that with all due respect. What are you working on next?
I just literally came home 2 days ago from having shot a film in Africa. Again, adopted child, if you can believe it.
Uh-oh.
This time, I bring my adopted child to, Africa, to kind of reacquaint him with where he comes from. Wanted to take him back to the orphanage where I adopted him from, and also, of course, on a safari. And during, an orientation meeting, he goes missing. And the film uses this kind of like, you know, sort of like a genre set up of the story to really get the possibility of showing what life is really like in the slum of Kibera outside of Nairobi. It's I think it's going to be pretty spectacular. It was a kind of a life-changing experience shooting it.
How long were you over there?
I was over there for 3 weeks, then we finished shooting the rest of it in Denmark.
Anybody else in it that we would know?
No, actually not. A couple of Danish actors, but not ones that have done international films yet.
Well, hopefully we'll see that very soon.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Okay, a couple film geek things I have to ask. Give us one anecdote that you can tell about on the air about Devil's Advocate.
I asked the hairdresser to set my hair in a way I really liked it, you know, to make it look very, very professional. And it was not a good idea. They almost got fired for doing it. Here's one I can tell you that is really amazing. You have to imagine, like, my first shooting day in America, having arrived only a month and a half earlier to New York from Italy, my first shooting day in America was the rooftop scene with Al Pacino and Keanu Reeves. I could hardly speak because I was shooting opposite. I mean, you know,
right.
Al Pacino was playing my dad. And, and so I almost couldn't even speak, just as it was because of that. And second of all, I was also almost dying of frostbite because I was wearing like this Calvin Klein evening gown.
Yes, I remember.
In minus 14 degrees or something. At least it felt like minus 14 degrees. Yeah. And do you know what the clincher on that one is?
What's that?
It turned out that there had been a mistake in terms of the stop on the cameras. And so this scene, which was the most expensive scene of them all, the entire Central Park had been lit up by the camera, I mean, by our crew.
Mm-hmm.
And you could literally, it was like the big, 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 big dollar scene. And they couldn't use it.
Oh.
They had to reshoot the whole thing in green screen.
Oh, my.
In the studio in L.A.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask about Gladiator, because there's so many shots. You should be allotted at least shots longer than, you know, 5 to 8 seconds.
Oh, thank you. I'll make sure that gets repeated more.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be in your resume quote file.
Thank you.
Connie, thank you so much for being on the show, and you know, hopefully this film will open in far more theaters across the country.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so too.
Well, Neil, I didn't realize I had royalty in my studio, because I know you have an official title, so I need to kiss your ring or your scepter or what, your crown.
I have an official title, but only for a week.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to renew that.
No, I have inherited my title from, I think, Julie Andrews, and I do not know who I will be handing it on to next year, but I am the honorary chairman of National Library Week. I get to be a spokesperson for all of the libraries in America, and I get to tell people not to close them and to go and use them and to cherish them.
Ah, so you came to Indianapolis at the right time.
I did.
Are we chaining ourselves to any libraries in the next couple of days?
Well, I'm actually going to be giving a big talk tonight that is absolutely sponsored by your local library world, which is rather wonderful. But no, I won't be chaining myself to any railings or throwing myself under horses. I'm just going to be urging people to use their libraries and to know what they've got. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in this world now where I keep hearing people telling me that libraries are so incredibly 20th century, as if Google replaced the library somehow, and trying to explain to them that the nature of information retrieval has simply changed.
I think with libraries, and for lack of a better comparison, video stores. I know, yes, you can get anything on the web and get it mailed to your home, and you don't have to see human beings. But I still think, especially a library, is a great example of the search, the hunt, and whether you get what you're looking for or you find something else that comes along your path. I think that's a thrill that needs to remain.
I look back at the years I spent as a schoolboy, hanging around school libraries, discovering books that I did not know that I wanted. They weren't things that I was looking for. In many cases, they looked extremely unprepossessing. I remember some very, very old, battered-looking red hardbacks. One was called The Fellowship of the Ring, which seemed an incredibly unlikely sort of title. And then they had one called The Two Towers, and there were just two out of these apparently three books. And reading them, and then getting to the end of The Two Towers and going, it can't end there. And so going back to the beginning and just reading those first two books of Lord of the Rings over and over again. And I don't know that I would ever have picked them up, but they were in the school library, and I was reading my way through it. So I read them.
And now they're on Blu-ray. And you can't read Blu-ray, really.
You can't. Or you can. Or you have incredibly sensitive fingers, possibly, to run around the disc.
That's true. Braille. What are you currently working on? I mean, whatever medium. It's literature, comic, film. What's it? What's in your office?
Right now, it's a bit of a gallimaufry. I've got. What am I working on? I'm doing a rewrite of an episode of Doctor Who that I wrote.
Oh.
I wrote an episode for the current season that was meant to be episode 11, but we ran out of budget. So my episode got bounced to early in season 6. So I'm doing a rewrite to take care of continuity issues and things from where it was to where it will be. I'm writing a film script for Anansi Boys, my novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a non-fiction book about China and myth and history, which I'm starting to get into and starting to enjoy. And writing a little children's book in down moments right now.
How do you select down moments? Or, I mean, as far as juggling and writing, I mean, is it based on what creativity comes from this project or deadlines? Or, I mean,
well, there's definitely a level on which who is shouting loudest for something and when it was really due by and when it is due by and whether or not their lawyers have started sending letters saying, please note the date of the actual contractual delivery has now passed by several years and we will ask for our money back. These are all important things in what you work on. And then there's other things like what you feel like working on that day. And I always like to have something on the go in little notebooks just to hand, because you never know when you're going to wind up stuck on a plane or a hotel or an airport lobby or somewhere. And it's really nice to just sort of go and go visit somewhere fictional.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, I love the idea of the credit writer slash producer. You know, many people say, like, when they argue about the Academy Awards, that really producer and director, best film, best picture and best director should be the same. And some of us say that best writer and best picture should be the same. So I'm wondering, I know you were executive producer on Beowulf and producer on Stardust. How much were you able, and I don't mean this way this sort of sounds, but I mean, how much creative control did you have in collaborating with both directors of those films?
I think the truth is that film will always be subject to budget limitations, a director's medium. I've now directed a couple of films, not very long ones. I did a half-hour film a few years ago, and last summer I got to, I had enormous fun directing an 8.5-minute silent movie called Statuesque, which got starring Bill Nighy. And in each case, what I liked best was I had the same power that I have as a writer in writing prose, which is the power of because I say so. Why is it like this? Because I say so. It's going to be like this. And that's something that you could have every producerial description in the book applied to you, whether it's executive producer, producer, or you can be the boss of a studio. And the truth is, a director is going to make the film the director wants to make. And the director is the only person in a film, really, who has because-I-say-so power.
How have you liked the film versions of your work so far?
I've really enjoyed them. I think I'm tremendously lucky.
Yeah, you have no visible scars, so it seems like it's...
No, I really don't. And I'm fascinated by them. I think people think I'm a bit odd because I tend to take an incredibly long-term view anyway. And I think of film adaptations of my stuff as being kind of like theatrical adaptations, which is they come, they go, they're really interesting, but the book is still the thing. I love Stardust, the movie that Matthew Vaughn made. I was a producer on it. I really, really enjoyed it. I can also absolutely imagine a world in which 15 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody picks up the book, reads it, goes, I love this book. Then they look at the film that Matthew made, and they go, you know, I want to do a different one. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this book. I'd love to make a movie of this, but it would be a completely different movie. It wouldn't be a sort of rollicking, comedic...
De Niro and drag.
De Niro and drag.
The most beautiful
thriller.
Witch in cinema history.
Absolutely. You know, it wouldn't be that thing. It would be something else. Coraline, I think, was slightly different in that the Coraline, when I finished the book, this is when I finished writing the book, 10 years ago, I looked at what I'd written and I thought, I would love this filmed. And then I thought, but if you filmed it live action, you're going to get something that no adult would be able to watch without being too creeped out, and I'm not even sure that kids would enjoy it. And I thought, but I love Henry Selick's work. Loved Henry most famously directed a film, or before Coraline, most famously directed a film called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which a lot of people, because of the title, think was directed by Tim Burton.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was by Henry. And I had seen the credits on that, and I had registered who directed it and who made that film. And likewise, James and the Giant Peach. So for me, there was only one person I wanted to do Coraline, and only one person I was going to send the book too when it was finished, which was Henry. And fortunately for both of us, he read it, he loved it, and then it took us about 5 or 6 years to get it set up. And then because it was stop motion, which is the most labor-intensive form of filmmaking on the planet, it took, you know, a year of pre-production set building and model building, and then 2 years of shooting. And on a really, really good day, they might get 11 seconds in the can.
And he has, of all the animators out there, I think his look is the most visible. You may not know him by name, but you know that look with the three films that you mentioned. And also, I think last year is going to go down as one of the best, if not arguably the best year for film animation between all of the stuff that was nominated. And congrats on the nomination.
It was so strange being in that year. And that we got an Oscar nomination in what may have been the best year for animation ever was an honor in itself.
And that could have been a category with 10.
Oh, it could easily have been a category with 10. And also, there was a level on which, and I say this in the best possible way, Up was nominated for Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, and you sort of look at that and you go, well, it won't get Best Picture, but it has to get Best Animated Picture because it's been nominated for Best Picture. So it was the most stress-free Academy Awards possible. We knew that Up would win. Everybody involved knew that Up would win. And
you got your swag bag and went out drinking afterwards.
And we had a wonderful time. Exactly. So from that perspective, it was great. I got to write the thing that I wrote that I think has had the most number of people ever seeing it, which is 15 seconds of Coraline dialogue in the Academy Awards. I wrote that for them, that little scene, and I'm going, I think that there's something ridiculous, like 250 million people watching this right mm-hmm. now.
That's fabulous. When it comes to adapting your work, first off, do you have it strictly that, you know, you get to adapt your own work and nobody else, or is it, I mean...
Truthfully, I prefer it when other people adapt my work.
Okay.
And I'm currently battling my way through an Anansi Boys adaptation that reminds me. The only reason I said yes to it was the BBC World Service had just done a radio adaptation of Anansi Boys that I had not liked and really hadn't liked, which meant that about a week after, I got a call from Warner Brothers saying they would like to buy the rights to Anansi Boys. Would I like to adapt it? And I was like, yes, I really do, because I want to do this properly. Now that I'm doing it, I'm remembering why I normally say no to adapting other people's stuff, which is simply, in order to build the thing in the first place, your mind goes down certain paths. When you're transferring something into a film, you either want to do exactly the same thing that you did before, which is a bit dull if you're a writer,
mm-hmm.
or you want to do something completely different just because it's fun and you haven't written it. And neither of these is, I think, terribly healthy for a writer. It's much more fun for me adapting something by somebody else, because then I can go with a completely clean conscience. I can look at it and go, well, you know, we can lose that character. I can't do that with my stuff. If I go, we can lose that character, in the back of my head, that character is going, no, why me? I was a good character. I was obedient. You can't lose me.
Well, I was curious also about your adaptation of Beowulf, because it seemed more, especially after a certain animated action film had come out, but it seemed more like a Shakespearean tragedy than, say, beefy guys screaming and hacking at one another.
It's a very odd film, Beowulf, isn't it? I mean, I think part of the fun of that, and which is one of the things that some people like and some people don't, and different people react in different ways, is what Roger Avery and I wrote a script for in our heads was for a $15, $20 million, low budget, lots of mud and dirt Beowulf that would have been kind of like Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky.
I was here. My first thought was Excalibur.
I think in our heads we had a weird mixture of Excalibur, Jabberwocky, and maybe Monty Python and the Holy Grail in terms of that kind of what we were trying to do. Bob Zemeckis fell in love with the script. And then, which suddenly meant that it was a thing starring Anthony Hopkins and Angelina Jolie and people. And Bob is also fascinated right now by motion capture and by performance capture and by ways of trying to do the thing where you get to mix live action performances with an animated thing that you're seeing on the screen. So it became this kind of thing that looks like a video game, but doesn't necessarily deliver. I think for a lot of people, it looked too much like a video game for the people who actually really would have loved the Shakespearean oddness. And it was too little like a video game for the people who would have really liked a video game movie. And the people who, for whom it would have been very funny and very weird if we'd actually done it as a Jabberwocky thing, they never really got to see that. I think Roger Ebert was about the only film critic I saw who basically said, I think I'm the only film critic who has noticed this is funny. And it is funny. And it's funny. People, it's funny, which I loved.
Now, I went online, because that's where I get all my research, and I saw that there's five titles in your IMDb page under In Development. So, may I throw titles at you and
throw,
you can comment?
Throw titles at I have to say that as far as I can tell, IMDb has the same kind of reliability as Wikipedia, which is anybody can go on and add anything they like.
Well, we're gonna straighten this out.
So go for it.
Here we
go.
All right. Graveyard Book.
Definitely in development. Neil Jordan is writing the script currently and is meant to be directing it.
Okay.
There's serious hope that we could be shooting by the end of the year.
Death, High Cost of Living.
Don't know. It's Death, the High Cost of Living is kind of like Traffic Lights. You know, I always thought when I was a young person entering the world of Hollywood nervously that the expression a green light meant that you actually had a proper green light for your film and you would go. And I didn't realize that it was kind of like traffic lights, because green lights for death go on, and then they go yellow, and then they go red, and then they go...
I was thinking the Monty Python song, but yeah, this one is...
So, it's very, very strange. Had you asked me that 4 days ago, I would have told you that we were closer than ever before to things happening. I'd just been contacted, and the deal had just been done for me to go in and do a rewrite of my original script, and everything was grand. As of 2 days ago, Warner's apparently suddenly have had a unified field theory for the entirety of Sandman and everything I created, which no longer involves, for which death is now on hold. So, I don't know. We'll find out.
We'll call you next week.
Exactly.
Road to Endor.
Road to Endor is wandering along. And it's kind of fun. It's a script that I've written with Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller.
Yes.
A true story about two guys in 1917 who escaped from a Turkish prisoner of war camp by pretending to have psychic powers and doing stage magic. And it's a completely true story about these wonderful people and the producer. There's a producer named Hilary Bevan-Jones, who I've worked with in London, who actually produced, Pirate Radio, she produced The Girl in the Cafe, and it actually happened to her grandfather. Her grandfather was one of these two people.
Oh, wow.
So she's working with us on it. Cool. And we're just waiting for, there is a director that we want. He wants to do it. He's been tied up on a franchise of films that has occupied him for several years now. I believe he's shooting the last of them currently, and then we'll see if he's available.
Okay. Interworld.
That looks like it's happening, but as a TV series, not as an animated TV series, not as a movie.
Okay. And finally, Black Hole?
Black Hole, Roger Avery, who I did Beowulf with, who did Killing Zoe and Pulp Fiction, co-writer of Pulp Fiction, and I wrote a script for Black Hole.
I guess I'm,
as far as I know, it's in a black hole right now.
Is this a remake of the Disney film of the
same
name?
No. This is Charles Burns' wonderful graphic novel
about
a sexually transmitted disease that turns kids into teenagers into monsters.
Completely.
And forces them to go and live in the woods.
On a double bill with the Disney film.
And
that black hole was blue, by the way. From 1980.
So no, all of the, actually that's not bad. But all of those films are actually real things.
Normally
when people say, "Oh, I've seen this on IMDb," they come up and say, "So are you really doing Doctor Strange with Guillermo del Toro?" And I say, "No, I'm not. I really am not."
Well, after a while, it just seems like, you know, for me, it's like I don't believe it until I see a poster and a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when actually things have happened. I had two friends. Well, basement-dwelling friends, who were going to come to fisticuffs over Ken Branagh playing young Obi-Wan in the first three Star Wars. And I thought, really, you guys are going to fight over that? So that's why we check in.
I love, I really do love the way that people seem to think that films are inevitable, that writers have supreme control, and... and that you can actually tell them what's going to happen with a film. The only thing that I know, having done all sorts of films and having knocked around in Hollywood now for 20 years every now and again, is nobody knows anything. And what will happen. And if you'd asked me in 1997 what film of mine was most likely to happen, I would have told you Beowulf. Because Roger, we'd just been given the green light and Roger was about to fly around Canada, Newfoundland, Greenland, looking for locations.
Places with mud.
Absolutely. And then if you'd asked me in 2004 if any of the film scripts I'd written would never get made, I would have said, well, definitely Beowulf. That one will never happen. That's sitting there. It's this complicated chain of ownership. Who's going to make that thing? And so I was wrong both times. These days, all I know is that they will happen when they happen.
And you love libraries.
And I do love libraries. you have a daughter.
I do. This is our film sociology kids film correspondent, Emma Sosi, and I know she's been chomping at the bit. You have questions and or comments for Neil?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how long did it take you to write the book?
Of Coraline?
Yeah.
You know, that shouldn't be a really hard question to ask somebody. You say, how long did it take you? And they tell you. The problem with Coraline, though, is I'm not really sure. I started writing Coraline in about 1990, maybe early 91. I showed it to an editor who read the first three chapters and said, Neil, which is what I'd written. And he said, it's really good, but obviously we can't publish it. Because it's horror for children, and that's too weird. And then I moved to America. So for a period of about 6 years, I would write about 2 pages a year on Coraline. I'd just go and write a little bit. By about 1998, I'd moved out here in 92, I noticed that the daughter I'd started writing it for, Holly, was now probably getting to be too old for it, and that I had a young daughter who was now 4, and if I didn't get a move on, she would be too old for it by the time I finished it. So I sent what I'd written of Coraline up to that point to my editor, a lady named Jennifer Hershey, and she phoned me up and she said, it's really good, what happens next? And I said, if you send me a contract, we'll both find out. So she sent me a contract, but I didn't have any more time. So instead of reading before bed, which is what I'd always done up until that point all my life, I started writing before bed, and I had a notebook by the side of my bed, and I would write 50, 60, 70 words of Coraline, and then I'd go to sleep. And then finally, in about 2000, I went on a cruise for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is a First Amendment organization I'm part of to preserve the rights of people who read, who write, who draw, who sell, who publish comics. And I was an attraction on this cruise, and I was meant to be working on my novel, American Gods. But my assistant had put, by serendipity, the wrong notebook into my bag. So I got to this cruise, and I discovered that the notebook I had with me was Coraline. So on the cruise, I finished writing Coraline. So the truth is, I started writing it in 1991. I finished writing it in 2000. I have absolutely no idea how long it actually took me to write.
I see. Sometimes I try to write a book, and it takes, like, when I was 5, I tried to, like, write a book. And I got, like, halfway through it when I became 6. So it took me to write just half of the book, and it only had, like, 5 pages.
Did you ever finish it?
I'm still working on it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Finishing books is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can start writing a book,
yeah,
but you know you're a proper author when you finish one.
Mm-hmm. Like, in our school, in our classes, we're writing a lot of books in our classes, just like small books.
I'm loving writing the small books right now.
Yeah.
They're sort of, apart from anything else, it's really nice to do something that you can finish by tea time.
Yeah.
Emma, do you have any other questions for our guest?
Also,
or comments?
Did anyone help you write Coraline at all?
No, it was all my fault. Any glory is mine, and any blame is mine, too. So for the people who think that writing Coraline was definitely a bad thing to do, I have to plead guilty.
I think it's good.
Good. I'll tell you what I did do, though. I stole the initial sort of idea from my daughter. Holly was about 4 years old. She used to come home from kindergarten. She would climb on my lap and dictate stories to me. And I would write them down, and they were always terrifying stories in which little girls, normally named Holly, would come home from school and discover that their mothers had been kidnapped by evil witches who were pretending to be their mothers, who would then normally lock them in the basement, and then with the aid of ghosts, they'd have to escape from the basement pursued by witches and go and try and find their real mother. And I thought, well, that's good. I'll write something like that for her, if that's the kind of thing she likes.
That's sort of like what happens in some of my dreams sometimes.
I think it's what happens in everybody's dreams.
Yeah.
My dreams involve Terry Hatcher, but that's a whole other. I can't.
His dreams involve pretty much girls.
Especially your mother. Neil,
good answer.
Yes. Oh, I'm the third smartest person in my house.
It's true.
Let's put it this way. It's a Jane Austen world. I'm just the dad. I was curious, what other screenplays have come out recently that have really tapped, that you've really enjoyed watching or listening to?
What's been coming out recently that I've really enjoyed? I loved the screenplay for An Education.
Mm-hmm.
McCombi. I thought that was beautifully constructed. And actually, the things that have impressed me no end recently are the first two Stephen Moffat episodes of the new season of Doctor Who, because I think Moffat is probably right now my favorite screenwriter.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinated with the way that he'll construct a story. And up until now, at least in sort of, you know, his work in Doctor Who and in Jekyll, he's been the scary one.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is watching him develop a whole new, have to learn a whole new range. He can't just be the scary one anymore. He has to be the welcome everybody in one, and then he has to be the exciting running about one, and it's absolutely fascinating.
I'm curious if Doctor Who fans are in England, what Star Trek fans are here in the United States.
No.
Not as rabid?
Well, it's a general thing.
Okay.
I mean, Doctor Who in England is a huge shared cultural experience. You're looking at the kind of viewing figures that tell you that 10% of the population of England is watching this when it's on. I don't know what that would extrapolate to in the US, but you're looking at something that is a shared cultural experience, and it's a shared cultural experience that goes back 45 years.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You got me there.
Has spoken.